Oh, hi, listeners. I didn't see you there. It's your host, Aisha. You are about to hear my chat with Isaiah Bell and Chris Mayel, who are two Canadian tenors. They're going to walk me through the entirety of Benjamin Britten's opera, Albert Herring, which is kind of incredible. By the way, in this discussion, because of the nature of the opera, there's a lot of talk about sexuality and sexual situations, so if that is offensive to you, then you might want to go listen to one of our many other episodes. Also, if you are offended by Canadian accents, you'll definitely not want to listen to this episode.
How is that for Canadian?
So anyway.
You guys say it's on your end, and we're like, what can we do? Maybe I can turn mine down a little more.
Sorry, buddy. about.
Sorry.
You know, we joke about... Trying so hard not to say about... just said about. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Okay. Think about...
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I said about...
Ooh, that's Canadian. Anyway, make sure to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes because it pleases the Queen when you do. All right, enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark secret. I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical... But I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know. And then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today, all the way from this country I'm told is called Canada, are Isaiah Bell and Chris Mayel. They're the co-hosts of the Overthought podcast. It's a podcast that investigates the lives of classical singers. More about that a little bit later. They're both Canadian tenors. Actually, I believe Isaiah is a Canadian-American.
Thank you so much.
In the last season... Isaiah sang with operas and symphonies in France, Montreal, San Francisco, and Toronto. He's also a composer who's written four operas. Also, FYI, he's a ginger. Chris has performed all over Canada and China and in England as well. He's a champion of new work by Canadian composers. And for the record, he's a brunette. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're extremely chuffed.
Yeah, thanks, Stacia. This is great.
So you guys are in Toronto, right?
That's right. And just a little bit of information, our podcast, which we've recorded many episodes of, this is the first time we've ever been recording in the same room because we were usually bi-coastal on the phone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's very disconcerting, but wonderful. Yeah, Isaiah lives in Victoria. I live in Toronto.
Oh, okay. And tell us a little bit about your show. Like, how did it come to be? What's sort of the gist of it?
Well, I think it sprang up from this idea that, so Isaiah and I have very similar voices, so we would often be cast for the same character, which means that we don't really get to see each other in any opera productions that we do. So part of the show was because I just wanted to talk with Isaiah more in the week.
Well, the amazing thing is we realized we were so similar when we first met, when we were double cast as Albert Herring.
Right.
Oh, you were double cast.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Two different casts, like on Monday... The cast A performs the role, and on Tuesday, the cast B performs the role. Yeah, totally. Especially in young artist programs or programs for students.
Yeah.
And so it's to be able to get more people the opportunity to sing their parts.
I see. And so you guys basically just wanted to chat more, and then you were like, these chats are so great that
basically,
everyone should hear them.
Exactly.
Yeah, and from that sprung forth this podcast, which... Every week we tackle a single subject that's near and dear to our lives, and we say it usually makes more questions than answers, but it's important that we share these things with other artists because a lot of these things we just keep to ourselves as artists that we're afraid to show these vulnerabilities, and it's great to have someone to share all this with.
Right, and the careers that you have and the things that you deal with are so particular to what you're doing. I'm sure, like, it's a very... unique sort of perspective that you're bringing to this world.
Well, I think part of the idea that's exciting for us is when people say, I've always had that thought, but I've never heard anyone else say it. Like, I didn't know that anyone else thought that awful thing, you know?
Yeah.
No one else has ever said that to me before. And the most exciting thing for us is when someone who's not a professional classical singer listens to the podcast and thinks, that was a thought that I had that relates to my life, and I'd never heard someone express it in that way.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you guys mentioned Albert Herring, and I believe that that's actually what we're going to be discussing today.
Coincidentally.
As it turns out, yeah.
Nice. Should we just dive right in?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. So why did you guys want to talk about Albert Herring by Benjamin Britten?
Well, other than the fact that it's the opera that we met on and that we both connect with the character really closely, from a wider world point of view, part of the thing that's so interesting to us about Albert Herring is that it's Benjamin Britten's really his only comedy of his adult operas, because he wrote some operas for children too. And there's Midsummer Night's Dream, which is part comedy and part drama. But it's his only comedy. And because of that, because the characters in it, many of the characters are portrayed in this almost cartoonish, you know, parodic, is that a word?
Parody-ish
sort of way. People have dismissed it for a long time, including when it first came out, as sort of a fluffy farce. And some people disparage it as being disparaging. Disparage it as disparaging.
You know, the critics after the premiere said that it was a waste of talent of all the, you know, the singers involved in it, that it was such a fluffy piece of art.
Yeah, because it's set in Suffolk, which is where Britten was from, and many of the characters, the townspeople, are drawn with almost caricature lines, you know, very deftly, very clearly, but you can recognize these caricatures of people. And because of that, people think of it oftentimes as a fluffy farce. And we're here to not only tell you about Albert Herring, but to sort of defend Albert Herring's reputation, because the thing that's amazing about it is it starts off with this incredible 15-minute scene of the town council. And that's where you get all the sort of parodic, that's a word that I may have just coined, but I'm going to continue using it because I love it.
I like it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the opera itself, we've talked about Britten once before on our show.
Yeah, Billy Budd, right?
Darren
Billy
Hagen.
Budd,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Remind listeners who Benjamin Britten was, when
yes,
he
of course.
Lived, etc.
Okay, so by the way, this is Isaiah speaking, just for the benefit of audience who can't see us. Benjamin Britten is a 20th century composer, British. He was born in 1913 and he died in 1976. He's known principally for his operas, but he composed everything else as well, ballets, many songs, orchestral works, just the whole gamut of what you can compose. His idiom was sometimes criticized for being too melodic because so much of the 20th century is about going against tradition, but he used tradition to connect with the audience, but he has this completely unique language that is only his, that when you listen to his music, you almost always know that's Britten.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, yeah.
And he's a personal favorite of both of ours, not least because he wrote so much for a certain kind of tenor voice, because his partner, as people say, his partner in life and music, his partner, because he was gay, Peter Peers was a tenor, and almost every single one of his operas, the lead role or a leading role was written for Peter Peers to sing. And
really?
We're tenors, and we like that.
Yeah.
And the reason we want to talk about Albert Herring is because the tenor stuff that's written isn't just about tenors sort of shrieking about being in love all the whole opera, which is what so much, no offense to opera, would we love opera. But Britten's roles, because Peter Peers was such an intellect, so much gives so much depth of character to the tenor role and to all the other roles. But as tenors, that's kind of rare for us. The soprano usually gets all the depth. So
okay,
that's part
of
why we love Britten so much.
This is great. So now we know a bit about who Britten was. Let's get into the opera. So I understand that we're going to be listening to a couple of different recordings of Albert Herring. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about why you chose these particular recordings and what they are?
Yeah, so the one of the recordings that two of the excerpts are from, I believe the final excerpt and the recording with Peter Peers, they're from a recording that Britten himself conducted with Peter Peers, who the role was created for, who's Britten's partner, singing the role of Albert, and Sylvia Fisher singing the role of Lady Billows. And we picked it because, I mean, it's kind of quintessential, and we really wanted to show Peter Peers playing drunk.
Right. Yeah. That's it. I think our favorite recording, more aesthetically, is this later recording, right?
Yeah.
With Stuart Bedford conducting and Barstow as Lady Billows.
Christopher Gillett or Gillett.
Yeah.
Gillet. I don't know.
Gillet.
Sorry, Christopher.
Okay. So you mentioned that the opera opens on this town hall. Should we hear some of that and then talk about it? Or?
Well, the terrible thing, Desha, is that there's so many excerpts from this opera that we want to play. And this amazing first scene, we only selected one selection just to show you the sort of boisterous, colorful mood that he gives you because there's so much else we want
to
play.
Right, but Isaiah, it is so hard, isn't it? So, Desha, you got to listen to the whole thing when this is all done.
Okay, so maybe we can just give a slight lead in to this excerpt before we... Okay, so what happens is... In this town, every May, they select a May queen who's this virtuous, virginal girl. But in this hilarious opening scene, they list every girl in town and find something wrong with every single one. And some of them are you know, she was found in a barn late one night with Tom O'Dare. But Chris, what
happened? Then, one Sunday she went for a trip with her cousin from Kent in a dog cart. All these reasons, like, she
can't possibly.
One day the postman, she came to the girl came to the door in her nightie when the postman called, and like, no, that's so improper. How could you do that?
So it's this real what's the word, burlesque kind of these really stuffy, uptight people, and they use these amazing words to describe the filth of the Loxford girls, like. It's everything stinks of sensual shame, and Loxford, which is the town that they live in, is a sty the female sex has soiled.
Oh, it's so
like
good.
It's just
wow.
and it's so it's awful and it's misogynistic, but it is this parody kind of, and it's the first part of the opera, and so throughout all this they can't find a girl and they're dispirited until one of them suggests, well, has anyone ever heard of a king of the May?
And which is this? So this is Chris. This is this king of the May ends up being Albert. So Albert is this character that is.
He's a grocer's lad.
Right, exactly. And his father's passed away, so it's his mother who is sort of keeping him in the store and keeping him sort of all these things, virtuous and chaste, but by default.
Exactly.
He hasn't had a chance to really find himself or really express that.
But we don't know that yet.
No.
All we know is that Albert Herring is this, they say he's keen as Coleman's mustard and he never kicks up rough as most boys do.
Right, a bit simple, but like he has excellent decorum. So finally they agree that this is the way to go because, I mean, there's no other choice. It's by default. So this excerpt is them celebrating what's going to be the King of the May. They all decide this isn't a problem. This is actually a great opportunity.
And it's this amazing theme that shows you exactly the bright neon colors that the townspeople are painted in when she's saying that'll teach the girls a lesson to have a May King.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. Everyone in this, Isaiah's already sort of said they're cartoony, but everyone's on their own little channel here. So like Bud the cop is just talking about the things that need to be taken care of for like, you know, we're going to have the police out in force. And everyone has their own little idea of what having Albert as the May King is going to be. And it's all holding up virtue as this amazing answer to everything.
So there's sort of caricaturizing not only virtue itself, but these sort of... townspeople roles that they're
yes, and this in. is why we want to defend Albert Herring is because it's so brilliantly painted at the beginning. These townspeople get the impression that the opera is just a buffoonery. You know, it's just a farce. Like this schoolteacher is this prim. She comes in one of her first lines is saying, "Oh, that hedge of rosemary is humming with bumblebees," and she's just so thrilled about it. You know,
yeah.
But anyways,
we could go on forever. Yeah, go ahead and play that.
Play the excerpt.
Okay, let's hear it.
So funny.
Wow. So they're all kind of, it's interesting how he's written this, where they're all sort of off in their own little worlds.
Totally, exactly. Talking about what it means to them. And what we didn't say, which is a total omission, is that this opera could be called Lady Billows, because this woman, this autocrat, this pompous, I mean, Lady Billows is a perfect name for it, is the one who suggested all this. She's putting up a prize of she was the one you first heard that extremely, Josephine Bairstow, this amazing British soprano singing it. But she's this just this pompous, billowy character, and she's putting up 25 pounds as a reward for this virtuous person. And the story actually is based on a French story by Guy de Maupassant called Le Rosier de Madame Husson, and she's that character, which is this woman who just will, with an iron fist, she says she'll teach them with a whip in Albert Herring that, you know, laws of morals must endure.
And she's losing this battle. So she was the Queen of the May many years ago when she was young, and she's saying that things have changed. You know, all these people are having kids out of wedlock and not visiting the vicar, right?
Or at least
not getting married.
Young mothers of whom remarkably few have taken the trouble of visiting you, vicar.
So that's why she's, you know, the stakes are so high. She's like, I'm putting up a prize this year, 25 pounds. You know, that's really going to make it clear to everyone that virtue is the most important thing in this town.
Right, because when you get paid for it, that means it's super meaningful.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So what happens next, so we've had this scene which is set it up, okay, this is the kind of opera it is. It's a buffoonery. It's a parody. And then we go immediately to the world of the young people. And this is something that is very close to Britain's heart. There's a lot of talk that we can talk about later about Britain's relationship with young people and his view of himself as perpetually young. But it's clear in all his operas that there's something about the vigor of young people and the strength of young people before it's corrupted by them turning to adults. And so as soon as we go from this, you hear the bright colors, and I wish we could play more of them singing because it's amazing the way he paints them in just it outlines, you know, characters like you'd see down at the docks, you know. And then we go to the young people, and they're so real, and it's so touching, the young people's lives. It starts with some kids playing a bouncing game, and then one they try to steal an apple. And then there's this whole story of Albert, and we see how much he's trapped in his life, you know, putting out vegetables, and how much he envies the life of Sid and Nancy, no relation to the Sex Pistols, BT Dubs, but those are their names, who are this heterosexual couple who are in love with each other and are able to explore their sensuality and sexuality with each other. And you can see him standing there saying, I'll be sleeping alone in my attic while they're off on the common, as the text says, my hand in your pocket, as she says to him.
it really is there, Isaiah. You're right. It's true. And this, the whole opera, I would say, the journey for Albert is all these sort of, he's trying to figure himself out. So as the opera begins, this is the end of the era of his life where he's not questioning anything. And as we go through the opera, we see him starting to question and figure himself out. Mm-hmm. And this entails all these mini sort of attempts at figuring himself out, all these mini anticlimaxes. So even like from this one where he sees Sid and Nancy, you know, he's starting to think about, he's starting to think about, you know, what he wants in a relationship, but he doesn't quite know it. He hasn't quite identified it yet. And then once he's alone after that, he's starting to get these thoughts. And one of the kids comes into the store and asks for food.
Bushel of herbs.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he has to go back to his job.
So the idea gets dashed. But as the opera goes on, he gets more and more opportunity and more things come up to sort of force him to face this part of himself and to self-actualize, right?
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
This is like incredibly progressive and nuanced, like what he's dealing with in this.
Yeah.
And the crazy, that's the amazing thing. That's why we want to talk about Albert Herring, is because it was a comedy and not a tragedy. Britain's other works dealt with similar subjects, but often from a different angle. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a truism that Britain's operas are always about the loss of innocence or destruction of innocence. His first opera, Peter Grimes, was about a man who beats and is responsible for the death of, or as the townspeople claim, this innocent young apprentice. The Rape of Lucretia, for obvious reasons, is about that. Many of his operas touch on it. But Britain himself rejected the idea. I'm reading this book called Britain's Children, about Britain's relationship to young people. And it says, although Britain later railed against the assumption that most of his works were about innocence, he did confess on radio that unconsciously there was something, quote, in that rather obsessive subject which can and does excite me or anyhow occupy me. But because this is a comedy, he's able to deal with these things in a much realer way because you're laughing.
Yeah.
And he can get much more topical and much more advanced and much more modern with it, you know?
Which comedy often does.
Exactly.
Like, you find yourself just laughing your head off and not realizing that the thing that this has caused you to think about is incredibly serious.
Exactly. Yeah. Like back to Beaumarchais' plays, Marriage of Figaro and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And even to now with the commentary that, you know, John Oliver does. And
yeah, we were talking about this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anything that we see on there, like John Oliver Daily Show. Yeah, yeah. It's a way to sort of get that information out there.
Anyway,
Amy Schumer, have you watched her?
Oh, my God, totally. Yeah, so progressive, right?
With entrenched, like, rape culture, the way that misogyny is just entrenched into the way we interact.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant.
But you're laughing at it because it's so ridiculously staged.
Yeah.
But you're realizing that what you're doing is sort of psychologically processing.
Exactly.
Oh, wow, that is really wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
totally.
Something is really wrong with this. Yeah, anyway, please continue.
This is Chris. One of the things that we would like to talk about, now this gets in a little bit to the realm of opinion, and it's a contentious issue, I guess.
Oh, so what happens next is that the townspeople come and announce to Albert that he's going to be the May King, and he, instead of being excited, his mother, who keeps him with an iron fist, is super excited, 25 quid and all this stuff, but he is mortified. Because, and this is another thing we relate to, because I think this is actually tying exactly what you were going to say, is that as young gay men, you can sometimes be virtuous by default because you don't necessarily want to do the other things that other guys do that are readily available. Anyways,
right.
So Albert is mortified. So they take him to the feast. They dress him all in white. They put a little crown of flowers on his head and they praise they basically truck him out in front of everyone and say, look at this virgin. Isn't that so great?
Okay, like, imagine that throughout the whole town. Yeah.
And you're like, Albert's a virgin. And hooray.
You know, they have, like,
just what every young man wants.
Exactly.
They have the kids, you know, the kids singing a little chorus.
Glory
for
to
him.
Our new making. Yeah.
You know? And he has to, like, hold these flowers
in
his hands like
girl.
A bride, right?
It's supposed to be a girl.
So they keep all the traditions that they would have for this chaste girl in a white dress. And, like, well, what do we do? White suit. We'll put him in a white suit. You
so
know?
It's the ultimate humiliation. And his friends, Sid and Nancy, who are these sexually actualized already people who are painted. We're going to play an excerpt just in a minute. Their music, which is some of the most beautiful music in the entire show, because it's this really honest, sensual music that's such a contrast to that bouncy music you heard earlier. But so they slip some rum into his lemonade to sort of just push him along the way. Like, we would love to see Albert burst away from this. We realize how humiliating it is. And so there's three excerpts in a row that we want to play now, and I'm not sure we can talk over them too. So the first one is Albert coming home after the feast, and he's still a bit excited by the feast because he doesn't know why he's so excited. He didn't know there was rum in the lemonade.
And you have to understand, so the plan with Sid and Nancy was just to give him just a little bit of rum to loosen him up. It was a benevolent act. But Albert gets hiccups in the middle of the feast. And so everyone says, "You drink more lemonade, drink more lemonade." So he downs like two glasses of this lemonade. Or he downs the whole glass of lemonade with rum in it and gets maybe a little bit too drunk.
As we're seeing.
Yeah.
And the reason we wanted to play this next excerpt was because Albert can also be a comedic character in addition to having this very serious core to his being, which is kind of the center drum of the opera, which is his struggle to realize himself, you know. But he comes home and this recording is Peter Peers, who was Benjamin Britten's partner in life and music, as we all say, who created the role of Albert. And his depiction of Albert's drunkenness, in addition to the way that Britten wrote it, is just so perfect. And also, maybe this is the point to say, okay, so the thing is, Albert Herring is not ostensibly a gay opera. There's no mention of the fact that Albert might be gay or not. But you couldn't write about that in 1947, and there's been a lot of scholarship that sort of implies that the omissions speak more strongly than any words that are in it.
Right, and to be fair and balanced, there's enough scholarship out there that says this is all, what would they say, codswallop or something like that. Like, there is nothing to this, right? But we see so many things here, and we admit fully that we're biased.
We're totally biased.
And
having played the role and played it from our own angle. But one of the things is in this excerpt, you can hear him singing really lyrically Swan Vestas when he's calling for the matches because he can't find the matches. And some research has shown that Swan Vestas were their brand of match, that was a code in nocturnal gay cruising circles. And also he says such things.
Isn't it?
And some people say, oh, that's digging too deep and all this stuff. But in addition to the other stuff that we'll explain later, it kind of makes sense. And also he says, open your mouth, shut your eyes, strike your match for a nice surprise, which is whatever. That's neither here nor there. But just let's listen to Peter Peers being drunk, which is amazing. It's written, the drunkenness is written in an incredible way that only Britten could do. And Peter Peers' description of it is just perfect.
Yeah.
Mom! Stupid. and the chat. Let me carry straight home to bed. But I'm blown if I'm ready for that. I'm blown if I'm ready for that. Dark in here. Must find a match. And after that, we'll light the gas with enormous care, not to break the mantle, set fire to the shop, or cause a scandal. Matches.
Wow. You know, I noticed that the orchestration in that, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Rite of Spring. I don't know if that's on purpose or if I'm...
Oh, yeah, can you hear the bassoon figure there,
yeah,
right?
Totally, yeah, totally, the bassoon. Yeah.
It should be mentioned really quickly, I think, Isaiah, you'll agree, that this is an incredibly difficult opera to sing and to play. It really stretches every player and singer
totally
to their limits.
Oh, this is the thing we should mention briefly, is that this was supposed to be a companion piece to Draper Lucretia. They're both written for a chamber orchestra of only 13 players, so all soloists, basically. Winds and a harp and percussion and stuff. And they were meant to tour together because he wanted to make opera more accessible for like different areas that couldn't, like not big opera houses. Mm-hmm. And so the orchestral colors are very interesting. And Stravinsky did that too in The Rite of Spring, where he highlighted the bassoon as a solo color. And that's something that really wasn't done in that same way before. But you can hear, it's amazing because it is difficult, but when you hear it done right, it just sounds like someone being drunk. But it's all notated, you know, it's all written. It's just part of Britain's genius.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Wow. So all of those little nuances of how he's
exactly
going, matches.
Yeah, matches. Like Britain knows how to write it so that when you do it right, it sounds drunk. And of course you add your own interpretation too.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It takes an incredible amount of time to learn this scene. I'm sure you'll agree, Isaiah.
Yeah, totally.
We still spend times off stage, little sessions of trying to figure this role out together. Yeah. Because like you say, once you get it, it just fits as a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
And then after a lot of hard work, it's sort of, if you do it right, then like you say, it speaks for itself. And then you never forget it. You know, some operas like a Rossini opera, or if I've sung a Bach piece, right? Like 3 years later, I couldn't do it from memory. But Britain, for all the work you have to put into it, I will never forget that role.
Totally.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
So this is Isaiah, by the way. I haven't been saying that enough. So what happens next is that he's drunk, and then he hears Sid, his friend, whistling outside the window for Nancy to come down so that they can go have a clandestine meeting in the woods or whatever.
Right, and sorry to interrupt you, Isaiah, but the whistling is also part of, theoretically, maybe like part of this gay culture again, right? The whistling as a sort whistles.
The codes, you know, like the handkerchief in one pocket, the earring in one ear, like all these codes that, you know, like if you make this whistle, like, I know this whistle, so I'm part of the club, so I'm safe or whatever. Anyways, but Sid, ostensibly it's set it up as Sid whistling for Nancy. But then after Sid and Nancy leave at the end of the scene, when Albert is deciding what is he going to do, is he going to make a break for it or not, you hear another whistle. And although it's already tied to Sid's whistling, Sid's gone. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, and so if you look at it, anyways, but that could be reading too much into it, but that's how I see it. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so what happens next is Albert's drunk, but then he hears Sid whistling, he hears Sid whistling, and... And he overhears this conversation between Sid and Nancy, and we're not going to play the first part, but it's them sort of saying, oh, poor Albert, the poor sucker, you know, they parading him around like the village idiot is what Nancy says. Like, I just feel so bad for him. And then Sid says, well, heaven helps those who help themselves. He's got to do it himself. He'll sow his own wild oats, you know, and all this stuff.
And I love this part. I was talking to Isaiah about this earlier. Just as this excerpt starts, I believe, where we're starting, it's just after Sid says, heaven helps those who help themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big, big, big moment for Albert, who's sort of like peeking in on them, watching them. There's this chord that's going to start this excerpt that I just find absolutely chilling. Some could say that it's related to Nancy, who's saying it's awfully cold out. But I think it's this moment of some barrier within Albert sort of shattering that he's realizing. Mm-hmm. Oh,
he's suddenly facing
all of this stuff, and it's like that top of the roller coaster, you know? And
he's sort of realizing his own responsibility in this.
Yes, exactly. He's the only one who can do it. Okay.
Exactly. It's his own, and we're going to get to that in later excerpts, but he's the only one that can take this journey, and that's the amazing part of this guy, and that's why it's so, I think, easy to love Albert and really feel for him, because the whole opera, the whole town and everything is set up so that he has no real role model for the journey that he needs to take.
Yeah.
And he has to figure out how to take that journey on his own.
Exactly.
I see. And that's when he leaves Tatooine and decides
exactly.
to go with everyone.
Nice tie-in. Okay, so this next excerpt is, I think, one of the most beautiful parts of the opera. Mm. It's just this very honest, very sensual duet between Sid and Nancy saying, time is against us as young people, we must seize the pleasures that we have when we have them. And this is the reason that I strongly disagree with this thing that's been asserted again and again about it being just a sort of a meaningless farce, Albert Herring, is that the old people are farcical so that it highlights how real and how uncorrupted in terms of their honesty and their integrity to themselves the young people are, which is this duet.
It's just so unbridled. I just want to say, I mean, you'll hear it, but you can feel the sort of sexual energy in this music. I mean, there's this glissando in the strings, which is pretty easy to read into, but also this driving, you know, it's like heavy breathing almost. It's so raw.
And Sid, the baritone, and when he says, kiss me, and he says her, just the way he says her name, Nancy, it's this great Canadian baritone, Gerald Finley singing Sid in this recording. And anyways, you'll hear it.
Round the clock, ticking and talking our evening away, which we hold for and long for all day.
What we didn't mention is that when he says "Give us a kiss, Nancy," I believe it's right there. Is Britain uses the Tristan chord, the famous Tristan chord from Tristan and Isolde, which is this that represents sort of that love that they find in the love potion and their special love that they share at night, and it's this amazing illusion. I don't know, but you can hear just like the real honest and the urgency of young physical love, you know?
Exactly, and it's unbridled.
Yeah. It's and you can hear her pulling back and saying, no, people will say this, people will say that, because the town is so constricting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they finally just give into it, and it's this beautiful release of emotion, and there's no way that you can say this is just some fluffy piece that doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah. I love that crescendo, and I love the line where she said, windows have eyes.
Totally.
It's so great.
Because we've both been to Oldborough. Chris has performed, by the way, I should mention because he won't. Chris has performed Albert Herring at the Oldborough Festival, which is the festival that Britain set up in England in his home area of Suffolk, where in his home, no, sorry, yeah, in his, hometown of Oberá, where he lived until he died.
With the conductor of this recording.
Stuart Bedford. Yeah. And I've also performed in Oberá, a different Britain opera. And when you're walking in Oberá, it's a small town still, and you really do get the impression that everyone sees you. And it's this very small town atmosphere that everyone knows everyone else's business. And that's a big part of this opera, is that the oppression, and we all know that, we should say to the listeners, this is another running theme in addition to the innocence and the destruction of innocence in Britain's operas, is this idea of one individual against the masses, one person, the outsider, who sticks out.
Right. I remember you guys spoke about this with Billy Budd, right?
Exactly.
So that's true in Albert Herring, too.
Peter Grimes, all these things, Gloriana. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the one thing that you touched on about how he's sort of made the adult figures into caricatures to, I don't know, sort of make the young characters' realness stand out in bold relief. It reminds me a little. I'm reading the Harry Potter series for the first time right now, and that's a lot of how J.K. Rowling, or Rowling, I can never remember, has written it, and it makes the young people and what they're going through really pop.
Right.
And you can just identify with what they're going through because the emotions are so human. Whereas, you know, in contrast to the adult characters who are, you know, like a Professor Umbridge who looks like a toad.
Whose name is Professor Umbridge. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, you're so lucky to be reading it for the first time. I mean, in Roald Dahl, it's the same thing, or even in Charlie Brown, where you hear the wah, wah, wah as the adults, you know?
Oh, totally. So that's like this loss of innocence and you know, now this, what is it, experience, right? The opposite, opposite of innocence, at least as Britain sees it, is experience. So becoming this adult. And so in this opera, it's like almost you lose your individuality and become your role. Right. So the mayor,
exactly.
Everyone in this this picnic scene where Albert gets drunk, everyone gets a chance to have a little speech.
Yeah.
And like the mayor's speech, for example, all he ends up talking about is how he funded the new
improvements
water
on Balaclava
mains,
Avenue.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, and it's like costing, like he got a good price on it, like per square foot or per yard or something. Everyone is stuck in their little roles.
Well, and it's an interesting literary tool or trope, this sort of making the adult characters out to be these sort of flat, two-dimensional, sort of caricatures, while the young people actually are they're evolving and growing, because ultimately the young people are going to grow into adults. It works. It works really well, obviously, like you know, writers have used it over and over again. But I mean, ultimately, you're observing the growth of a young character.
But this is something that...
And that character is going to grow into an adult.
It was very close to Britain's heart because he, I mean, for whatever reason, there's talks of why this might have been that aren't necessarily substantiated, but he often said that he felt sort of that he was 13 for his whole life. And he throughout the course of his life, and it's a very fraught subject to even discuss, but there's a whole book about it, this book, Britain's Children, that I quoted from earlier, which discusses his relationships. He had many relationships throughout his life with 13-year-old boys, and the evidence seems to suggest that they were innocent relationships. He was a gay man, but the evidence seems to suggest that they were platonic relationships that he had, but really close relationships with his young boys, closer than he had with his adult friends, because he would say, I'm always 13, I never grew out of that.
Despite being this brilliant man.
And then he wouldn't, exactly, and he was a brilliant genius, but he was always a child in some ways in his mind, and he hated to go to these guys' weddings. He hated to see them grow up.
So there is
that thing, that sort of Peter Pan desperateness to not grow up, even though it's inevitable.
So it's argued, it's argued back and forth with scholars, which we aren't, right, Isaiah?
Yeah, exactly. No, we're just a couple of tenors.
That you know, Albert is a sort of an autobiographical character, that
exactly.
There's a lot of Britain in it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But you were talking about how the adults, like in so many pieces of literature, are two-dimensional, and that's where Albert sort of starts before the opera, right? Just by default.
Yeah, he is going on that path. He says, you know, each morning I get up at 6 and tidy up the stock. I do this. I know about root vegetables and strawberries.
But for what, right? That's
but
that
for
first
what?
Time
yeah,
where
he's
starting to think where and figure it out, right?
Right.
And again, this thing that you and I have certainly explored in our portrayal of the role is this idea that he's coming out as gay.
Yeah.
And it's that, I mean, imagine that. I mean, we're lucky, you know, you and I, Isaiah,
some
to have been
models.
Born at the time when we were born, that it was easier. If I'd been born in the 40s, I probably would still be in the closet
and
with
married,
a wife
yeah.
and kids, yeah. you know?
So So this next excerpt is exactly that. He's just heard this thing that we just heard, Sid and Nancy, and seen them reveling in this love that he will never be able to experience. And he's shouting at them in this next excerpt, just go away. Go and leave me alone with doubts and terrors that you have never known.
And I love that because if you really look at that, he's saying that he's on the cusp of facing something that he knows no one else has had to face. So he's not just saying, I'm afraid to figure out love. He's saying, you two that are in love in this heterosexual relationship that basically is approved of, except for the fact that, you know, it's maybe out of wedlock, blah, blah, blah. It's still not something that's totally improper. He's starting to know, we think, that that's something that he's about to face.
Yeah, and whether this is autobiographical or not, I mean, it's clear Britain was not a simple country boy. He was an upper middle class, public school in the British sense, boy whose mother, like Albert's mother, this is where the parallel is, was very domineering and would say, okay, you're going out to play at this time, you're coming home to practice this time. She wanted him to be the fourth B, like Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, and Britain. And in a way, he is. But what's happening in this scene has a really striking parallel with Britain's life, which it wasn't until his mother died when he was 23 that he could actually come to terms with his own homosexuality. And Albert is doing the same thing in this scene, breaking away. And it's only because of the extreme shame, humiliation caught between being paraded around as the virgin forever, his whole life, and being laughed at by these friends of his who have some measure of what he wants to have. And so this is just a short scene where he's making that choice.
Yeah, and you can still see him working it out. This isn't the sort of this isn't the climax of his figuring out all these thoughts. So I think in this excerpt, it includes the part where he's musing upon Nancy, right?
No, it isn't.
Okay, cut that part, Todd. You can go ahead with this.
That's Nancy and Sid in the background still singing their duet.
Mm.
That's really haunting sounding.
God, it's so heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. as having sung this role in, I don't know if anyone's talked about this on the show before, but when you're singing an emotional role that you connect to really closely, there's something that you have to do where you have to have experienced the emotion beforehand. So in the show, you can't go all the way with the emotion because you will not be able to sing or perform it. And it will be inward instead of telling the other people about it. And in rehearsals for this, I just remember feeling so keenly this feeling of being, when you're a young gay person, especially coming from a small town, you have no friends that are gay, you have no role models, you don't know if it is a thing that can happen. This feeling of that he says of watching other people, you know, enjoy your evening and just laugh at me who will be sleeping alone like always and knowing that I'll never be able to experience that thing that you have, that beautiful connection, it really resonates. And I think that's part of what's amazing about this and part of which does support the gay reading is, of course, I mean, it can speak to other people who feel alone and who feel like others are enjoying life.
Oh, sure,
too,
sure, but, yeah. But it's like he's seeing this change coming, and this is probably stretching it, but it's like the stages of mourning something. You know, he's in the anger stage now of this transition of finding himself. So he's, you know, now he's, because he's gone through all these things, now he's lashing out at, you know, Sid and Nancy and everyone, and he's saying, Mrs. Herring's, everyone sees me as a joke, Mrs. Herring's guinea pig, Mrs. Herring's tilly pig, Mrs. Herring's prig.
Yeah.
You know? And then again, he still hasn't figured out. He's like, but what
how?
Do I do?
But
you
how?
Know? But how? Yeah.
How will I do this thing that everyone does, which is break out and become themselves when I can't? And eventually, he's ranting to himself at the end of the scene, and he slaps his thigh in anger or something, and he feels the jingle of these 25 sovereigns that are in this purse of otter skin that Lady Billows' father, she shot the brood in 76 or whatever. Hilarious townsfolk stuff. And he realizes, hey, I can use this money to go do whatever I want. He's just got a bit of liquid courage in him still from the rum. And so he runs off. This is the point actually where after Sid and Nancy have gone up the hill, we hear another whistle. But even though we know Sid's already gone, and he's like, what's that whistle? And so he goes off after it. And the next morning, everyone's running around in a panic because Albert, the May King, is still, they can't find him. And there's all these scenes, people wondering what's going on, more hilarious townspeople pastiche stuff. I wish we had more time to play it because it's just amazing. It's all perfectly written. But they find his crown of flowers, the crown of orange blossoms,
found on the road to
Campsie Ash,
crushed by a cart.
It's so good.
And this amazing moment happens. Chris, do you want to talk about this moment? That's the next final excerpt.
Yeah. So this moment, that this little spot in the opera has been criticized, or was criticized at the time, for being maybe a little bit too much of this dramatic counterweight in the opera, that it was too much of a counterweight, that for a few moments, if you only heard this as an excerpt on its own, you'd think, wow, it's incredibly deep, complex, moving stuff. There, it's this threnody that they're all, mourning his loss. And again, we still stay in this mode where everyone is mourning his loss in their own ways and sort of on their own channels. Isaiah and I have both had this experience of, because, you know, at this point we're off on our bender, or it's the morning after, we're on our way back. So in the rehearsal hall, we would just be sitting at the side watching this happen, being staged or practiced or whatever. I remember times being so moved by this and thinking, wow, I am so fortunate to be, you know, privy to this. It's such moving music. And you have these, nine people on stage.
Yes,
working together to create this astounding music, and it's just me hearing this. What a shame! What a waste!
It's wasted on me. I wish the audience could hear this.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear it.
Sure. Yeah, please.
We love that part. So that's the mayor. He's always this bombastic, you know, loud singing guy.
Oh, yeah.
And this thing continues on
and culminates
in this beautiful, you know, everyone's singing it together.
Grief and silence
grief
or something.
And silence, yeah.
This outburst of grief and passion and emotion.
And they've all, by the end of this piece, decided that he's dead. And you know, their heads are down, and we hear the timpani just go boom, boom, boom. Boom. And I know this as you do, Isaiah, because we have to count. We're side stage like one and two and three. Okay, enter now. And then he just sort of enters
and
on
the door,
scene.
The door jingles.
Yeah.
You know, like customer, bling, bling.
Yeah, exactly. Albert.
And so they're all just shrieking at him, where have you been? You've ruined everything. Because for a minute, all these people who in their own worlds were stuck on the timepiece and the hedge of rosemary bubbling with bumblebees and all this stuff, they've all come together for this beautiful, perfect moment of music when they thought he was dead.
Yeah.
But when they realize he wasn't, they're enraged with him, and they said, what have you done? You know, you are a May King and you've disgraced yourself and stuff.
Right, everything is about tradition and ritual. There's a whole aria earlier on where Florence, Lady Bill's assistant, just rips Sid to shreds because he was late with the meat for the picnic, and then the aria ends with, lateness on May Day is quite What is it?
Indefensible.
So Albert ruined May Day. They're not like, you know, we were worried about you.
Yeah, they immediately forget they thought he was dead. They're like, you, one of the things that they say, which is so funny, is wrecking the whole of our daily routine.
Oh, yeah. That's the culminating of it. And he says, and this is great, all on the same frequency. And he has, whatever he's done that night, he's found himself and he's sort of above, impervious to that now.
Yeah, and he doesn't take on their, because Chris was saying,
doesn't take on their energy, right?
Throughout the whole show, yeah. Albert often takes on the music. Musically, it's a device that should show that he sort of takes on what other people give him. He's just swept along by whatever musical motive is happening at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, really compelling,
all these people are just shouting at him, and he just goes, sorry. And they say, where have you been? And he goes on and they ask him all these questions like, did you meet friends? Male? And then before he can answer, someone injects, and female too, right?
I love that. It's written right into there. There's this whole interrogation with yes and no's.
And he nods and then he goes on this, he says, yes, so I can't remember everything, but you know, I went so far, I went to this pub and got drunk, and then I got in a fight and blah, blah. And then he stops short at this telling moment where we know that it wasn't just that he got drunk and got in a fight and something else happened. It's really clear, but he says, now, that's some of the truth. Do you want some more, or is that good enough? And he says it's an example of drunkenness, dirt, and worse. And he doesn't say anything else, but he just says, that's what happened. Do you want more? And of course, they're just outraged. Lady Billows flies off in one of the best exits ever in opera, where she just goes, bah!
And in one production, that's when I, just before she says bah, is when I mooned the amazing Felicity Lott.
A famous
being the the Lady Billows. That's all she can say. Faw, right?
That's great.
And so then he tells his mother it's all because you squashed me down and all this stuff, which I don't know if that was a rant against Britain's own mother, who he also loved very dearly, but who he felt was constrictive force.
Sure.
And then the opera ends in just these kids, Sid and Nancy, and the three children who were playing the bouncing game and et cetera, were at the feast and stuff. And Albert just, him handing out these peaches that they were trying to steal earlier, and them just saying he's back to stay, and just celebrating the sort of that they achieved what they needed to achieve, and they are themselves still. And Albert has achieved himself and self-actualized, and there's no adults around.
Oh, this is the best and worst part of opera, because there are so many things to tell you. But one thing we should tell you is earlier on, between Sid and Nancy in the shop, Sid offers Nancy a peach, and she says, "You're like, oh, there's it's so ripe and juicy, it might splash." You know, like the peach is this.
And we'll keep it for later to flavor our kisses, you know.
Exactly. So the very, very last thing we hear in the opera, the very last words which are sung, are Albert saying, have a nice peach. So now he's it, like he gets it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what I've been thinking as you guys have been telling me about this is that it's, you know, it. I can see where scholars are torn on whether or not, although there seems to be some weighty evidence that it is about sort of coming out as a gay person.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, I guess, such a universal story.
Exactly.
You know, having the courage to be oneself in any way and to be different than the, you know, the powers that be and to have the courage to really live life as opposed to sort of just going along with this quotidian existence and sort of, you know, assuming your role and all of that kind of thing. Like, I think that's a very, like, I can see where people are sort of torn on that, listening to this opera, about.
The great thing is that you say, I mean, we, coming from where we come from, and there's some scholarly research to back it up and et cetera, you know, there's a lot of subtext. But in a way, the great thing about the opera is that it doesn't say any of that, and it doesn't say this is a gay opera about a young man coming out. And you can go to it and never get a single one of those clues, and it doesn't matter because it's a universal theme. I mean, when we were talking earlier about the podcast, something that's great is something that's extremely specific but also can apply to anyone who's experienced that universal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I wanna go and listen to it on my own now, or maybe even see it.
See it. You must see it. Actually, it's something that has to be seen because Britten's work is so theatrical. He has such a sense of drama on the stage. Because even what Darren Hagen was saying to you last time we listened to that episode about Billy Budd, about that dramatic moment where the high point of the drama that he talks about, the 11 o'clock moment, happens off stage, and Britten's sense of the strength of that, and all these things in Albert Herring. It's a similar thing where so many things happen off stage that are the key moments, and it just draws you in because you don't see it all explicitly. You don't see Albert drunkenly starting a fight in the background.
Uh-huh. But don't see the made for TV movie, would you agree?
Okay.
That one with the, like, the they go wild on the accents, like, it's like,
no.
Albert's gone back again.
Well, maybe, no, it's the 1985 Glamourne production. It's totally worth seeing.
It's a viewpoint, yeah.
All I wanted to say about this is just that basically the closing remarks is that we want people to realize that this is both a comedy, but like The Marriage of Figaro or Ariadne of Naxos or any great comedy in opera, it's a comedy that has a core of truth to it. And that because it parallels Britain's own struggle for self-actualization or not, but it still spoke to us really deeply in a way that many operas haven't been able to connect with our personal experience because they're about sort of more generalized, more universalized themes.
Yeah, what a pleasure to get to do this role and really feel like we're drawing on ourselves.
And this should be what modern opera is about, you know, I think. And opera should be about that. It should be about connecting with people now, so.
Right. It should be about modern stories. And, you know, and really good literature, really good opera is still about very modern stories because those themes continue to be universal over the ages. But,
totally.
But this is, you know, this has even contemporary and modern elements in it that make it very accessible, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm always going on about this on the podcast, but right now I'm obsessed with Japanese poetry from the 9th to 11th centuries. But the amazing thing about some of this poetry is that you can read it and it was as if you wrote it last night when you were sad, you know?
You said it made you so sad, but these people have been dead for thousands of
years.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And it's just
so real.
Any great thing, it's just these feelings feel so modern, but it could be written anytime by a person in any culture and it can relate to you. And that's the mark of great art.
Hmm. Well, and do you think that this story of Albert Herring is going to be one of those, but where people read it, you know, centuries later, listen to it centuries later.
I hope so. It's an interesting, you know, I often wonder if the English, you know, this town in Suffolk, if that aspect of it is lost on people that may not, you know English culture. It's hard for us to say as Canadians being, you know, part of the Commonwealth that we're sort of still in on all of that. I don't know. But
it has,
as you say, the elements at the base of it, this person struggling to find themselves, this outsider trying to become themselves in the face of all these people telling them opposite, is, I think that's always going to be a thing, right?
Well, for me, I mean, it has been criticized as being parochial and all those stereotypes. But for me, the reason that I am so passionate about defending Albert Herring as not a comedy is that I think it will have a lasting effect because musically it's amazing and dramatically it's very interesting if people who are performing it don't treat it like a joke.
I see.
I think that it's something like this, if you see a production of The Marriage of Figaro or even The Barber of Seville or any comedy where all people are doing is just going, wah, 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 isn't this funny, mugging, 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 then it has no meaning. Then
right.
It just becomes another
entertainment.
It's a tricky
balance. Like, we're not saying don't play the jokes. Play the jokes that are there, but...
No, but that's the thing. If everyone in every comedy plays it as if it's serious to them, the jokes will speak themselves. Mm. And if you're going to A Marriage of Figaro that's just jokes, 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 all you see is how dated it is and how much it doesn't relate to our current culture and all the flaws of it that haven't survived time. But if it's played as people are really experiencing those experiences seriously, like we've tried to describe with Albert and his friends, then I think it is a piece that has everything that requires to stand up the test of time.
Yeah, because what makes Ron Swanson in Parks and Rec funny is that he plays that role so straight.
Deadpan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Takes himself totally seriously.
Isaiah Bell and Chris Mayall, thanks so much for being on The Classical Classroom. This has been great.
Oh, thanks. We had such a good time. Thank you.
We're so stoked to be able to talk about this. We love it. Thank you.
And oh, by the way, we should tell people how they can find your podcast.
It's called Overthought. So in the iTunes store, you can just search for Overthought and it'll pop up. And our website is overthoughtpodcast.com. And there are easy links there to subscribe in many ways.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Stacia.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can find us all over the social media, the Twitter, the Tumblr, YouTube, SoundCloud, Snapchat. Make sure to subscribe to us and rate and review us on iTunes because it's awesome when you do. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Overtod Holslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing hoser eyes. Thanks to Isaiah Bell and Chris Mayall for being here today all the way from Canada. And I'll make sure to put links about their podcast up on the information for this episode. Sorry, I kind of botched that sentence. Eh? Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.